I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Little did Frank Langfitt know when he graduated from high school in 1982 and drove a cab in Philadelphia and the surrounding suburbs that those skills would serve him well when he was the NPR correspondent based in Shanghai. This happened during his second assignment covering China. The first was for the Baltimore Sun, and it was a time of dramatic change from 2011 to 2016. While the country's economy was booming and the government was investing in massive infrastructure projects, it still maintained tight control over the people, often afraid to speak their mind, making it tough to report on the new China. So Langfitt decided to buy a cab and offer free rides in exchange for conversations that he used for his stories. And like in Philadelphia, riders often opened up when sitting in the back of his cab. Here's a clip from one of his stories about a man he got to know, Chen, a Christian pajama salesman.
Now, Chen makes up to about 10,000 bucks a year selling pajamas. He's lower middle class by Shanghai standards. This is a very expensive city. Chen has a wife and two daughters, but they live in suburban L.A. Chen and his wife, they went there last year to have a second child, a girl, because they couldn't afford the fine for violating China's population policy. Chen's family stayed in California, mostly for the education of their elder daughter, who's about 14. Chen says she was miserable in the Chinese school system because it's such a pressure cooker.
Sometimes my heart ached for the kid. She always left school very late. She would eat very fast and do her homework until 10 p.m. Each year, her eyesight deteriorated and her personality gradually became more introverted.
Chen says his daughter is a lot happier in L.A., and eventually, he plans to join the family over there.
Frank Langfitt has written a book about the people he met driving his taxi cab. It's called The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. He's now based in London and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Frank Langfitt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty, and nice to be back in Philadelphia.
And nice to have you back in Philadelphia. So what is it about a cab that allows people to feel free to open up?
Well, this is what I found when I first started driving with Narberth Cab and then later Kenwood Cab. In the first 18 years of my life here in Philadelphia, like most of us, we live in a sort of pretty enclosed area. We go to a few towns, things like that. The taxi cab allowed me to meet all kinds of different people who also took me to completely different parts of the city where I'd never been before. And a taxi cab can be like a confessional. Often the passenger thinks they're never going to see this person again, and so they'll talk pretty openly. There were times also where I met people who were in the midst of a lot of trauma in their lives. There was a woman I met one night in her house with suitcases, and she was leaving her husband, as I recall it, and then just poured out in the cab. It was a confessional. So I found that was my experience here in Philadelphia, yep. And I tried to take that model and transport it to Shanghai about 30 years later.
Well, it's interesting, and I don't want to spend the whole hour talking about what it's like to ride in the back of a cab, but it is both sort of intimate and anonymous.
It is. I mean, it's very intimate, and I think especially in China. So, for instance, in Philadelphia, you can walk out, you can talk to a stranger on the street about any number of topics, and nothing is sensitive. You can't really do that in Shanghai. You can chat about a lot of things, but certainly you can't talk about the leadership of the country too much. You can't talk about all the repression right now. And so the cab was a safe space for people to sort of chat and open up. And what I found also was that when folks got in the cab, they usually would interview me.
Oh,
so the whole reporting process, and I didn't realize this was going to happen. I'm not that clever. But they would get in the cab. And so instead of an American reporter trying to extract information in a politically sensitive environment, they were just saying, what's up with the taxi cab? Do you have a lot of these in different cities? They were just asking different questions. And they felt much more comfortable because they felt they had started the conversation.
Well, there were a set of signs that I guess you chose.
Yeah.
One called Free Loving Heart Taxi. That's a translation. Another called Make Shanghai Friends, Chat About Shanghai Life, or I Love Shanghai. These were the signs.
So the question we had was, how do you actually make this thing work, right? Because I couldn't get a real job as a taxi driver. I tried. I failed. They said, I think the taxi company said, foreigners don't drive cabs here. And I was often getting this, like,
you said, not this foreigner,
like,
right?
How how long you've been living in China that you don't know these things. So my wife, Julie, came up with the idea to make magnetic signs that we could put on the side of this Camry that I had. And then my news assistant, Yang Zhuo, a Chinese guy, came up with these slogans. And so we had the actually quite clear messages in Mandarin what this was about. And so when people got in, they kind of had an idea that, A, it wasn't going to cost them anything. So that sounded really good. And they were happy to chat with somebody, a foreigner, and kind of I was pretty anomalous.
Well, you describe flying into Shanghai, and I should say this was your second tour of duty in China, but this is a city of 24 million
people. It's probably 26 now, since I mean, it continues to grow.
The size of Delaware, as you describe it.
It is. It's an enormous city, and it's incredibly dynamic. I would say that I live in London right now, which is also a fast-paced city. I've just been in New York. I think Shanghai feels more dynamic, and it's of course, you're talking something that's three times the size of New York. And then if you look at the skyline, it dwarfs Manhattan. I mean, I go to Tokyo, and I think Tokyo's nice, but it's nothing like Shanghai. In my neighborhood, there were three buildings taller than the Empire State Building.
Were these apartment buildings or buildings?
These were financial towers. They also had hotels at the top of them. I mean, one of them was over 2,000 feet. And we watched go up over 5 years. We were about three or four blocks away from where I lived with my family in the financial district.
That's wild. I wonder if you could read a section from your book.
Sure.
And this is a description of what it's like, or what it was like for you, I guess, to drive in Shanghai.
People battle for resources in Shanghai every day. In a city of 24 million, there isn't enough to go around or quench the ambitions of so many. Traffic is a delicate game of inches, where you tap the accelerator and tap the brake, nosing your way past the competition while taking care to make sure your vehicle never quite touches another. At rush hour, riding the metro may mean stuffing the person in front of you into a subway car like a mattress into a closet. Some people here see life as a Darwinian contest for space and spoils, favoring the most cunning, best connected, and least morally encumbered. Others envision an emerging society in which people consider the welfare of others and the greater good now, that many no longer have to worry about the basics of food, security, and shelter. Each day is a battle for the soul of the world's largest country, fought in thousands of small skirmishes.
I really like that section.
Thank you.
In part because I think it just helps us understand this dynamic country and what it's like to live in a country growing through such dynamic change, but also having a government keeping a tight lid.
And I think there are a couple of things in that paragraph, and I'm really gratified that you chose it. One is, it's an incredibly competitive and exhausting life. I think most Americans and people in the West, many will feel Chinese are taking jobs from the West. The fact of the matter is multinational companies sent jobs overseas and Chinese people took them and worked them and did them very, very well. But the 30 to 40 years of rapid change has left many of the passengers and people I got to know, they're exhausted. Right. I mean, people are so stressed out. There have been so many changes. And the other thing that's in captured in this paragraph is it's not all Darwinian. As people have made more money and they're not as concerned about the daily needs, they are looking for more dignity in life. They are looking for more charity. And so there really is also a battle for the soul of the country amongst people who still are kind of, frankly, you know, you meet a lot of schemers in a city like Shanghai, but you'll also meet a lot of very thoughtful and enlightened people. And I came away really admiring the passengers and the people I got to meet.
Well, I got the feeling reading your book that you have such affection for the Chinese people.
Well, they're remarkable. They've been through a great deal and also what they've accomplished. I mean, in no period in modern history or perhaps human history have we seen so many people rise so quickly economically. And these cities, you know, when I first went to Shanghai, the financial district was largely flat. They were finishing one skyscraper. Now it's, you know, much, much bigger than what you see in much of Manhattan.
And Frank Langfitt is our guest today on Radio Times. If that's a familiar voice to you, he was the NPR correspondent based in Shanghai. He's now based in London. And you can join our conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We heard Chen in this clip that I played. Tell us more about Chen and his family.
He was interesting because the reason he caught my attention is that at the time I got back, China was still, I guess, growth had begun to slow, but there had been this enormous economic boom that had proceeded over the previous 15 years. And if you looked around Shanghai at all the shiny buildings and you met people who were increasingly more sophisticated, you thought, wow, I mean, this is almost felt like the center of where the action was in the world. What was fascinating about this pajama salesman is he had an exit plan.
Yeah.
Like, he was not buying into it, and he wasn't alone. Many millionaires have been getting their children out, their money out for many, many years because they don't see it as politically sustainable. There is no rule of law to protect them in case the government gets mad at them. And I found Chen a really interesting figure who just wasn't buying into this. The interesting thing about these passengers that I got to know, the people that I met driving the cab, is that I chose about 8 or 9 of them perhaps, mm-hmm. and I continued to follow their lives over the next 4 to 5 years. And as some moved around the world, as Chen did, I did actually go visit him in Los Angeles. And
so he lives there now?
He lives in L.A. And he was able to make it out, and he I believe he has a green card now.
Wow.
And so I went to visit him to see how he was building a new life in California.
Well, we heard him mention that his wife was in L.A. because of a second child, and that obviously a penalty
yes.
in China.
Yes, so
for
under the
child.
One-child policy, which no longer exists, mm-hmm. which is really striking, they couldn't have a second child, and so they decided to go overseas as well, also because they were so concerned about their older daughter. So they had a second child. And the other thing that was interested in doing this longitudinal reporting, where you're spending a lot of time over the years with people, is there are secrets and things that they won't tell you in the first 3 years because for obvious reasons, they don't share with many people. In the end, what I learned, and there are lots of surprises in the second half of the book, things I didn't see coming, things I wasn't aware of. But what I learned when I visited them in Los Angeles is one of the main reasons that they had also left is that considerably earlier, Chen's wife Gong had been put through a forced abortion by the government. And we sat, and it was a really painful story. We were sitting in their kitchen, basically, and she told the story over about 15 or 20 minutes what it was like to be dragged out of her apartment to be
And you mean that
to
literally?
Basically, someone in the neighborhood took a payoff from the government to inform on her. She had no choice. She tried to think of ways to escape, but she couldn't. She was surrounded by these thugs.
Do you know how pregnant she was?
I can't recall, but she had been, I think, fairly far along if somebody already knew that this was the case, right? So she ends up being strapped down. And I don't want to go into the details. It's sort of hard to, frankly, talk about on the radio, but it was awful. I got to say, though, what was remarkable about her and a lot of people that I got to know is the incredible resilience. This didn't break her at all. She said, this is not a place where I want to live. I want to go someplace else. And then she went out and rebuilt her life in California. That meant at times sleeping in her car, her daughter going and washing up before school at a McDonald's. So there's remarkable resilience that I found among many of these folks.
We're almost up on a break here. Are they happy in L.A. from what
they
you
are,
can tell?
They are happy.
Right,
and you know, and their daughter, their younger daughter, first of all, I think their older daughter is doing better, is a bit happier. Their younger daughter is absolutely happy-go-lucky American girl who eats pizza and hamburgers. And it, honestly, when I spent time with them, it's like two families. There's one family that started off in Shanghai, and now there's new kind of Chinese-American family.
That is Frank Langfitt, again, our guest on Radio Times today. Spent about 5 years for NPR as the NPR correspondent based in Shanghai, China. And again, he's got a new book called The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. And he is now based in London, where he is the NPR correspondent covering things like Brexit and the president's trip to London. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and if you are just joining us, Frank Langfitt is our guest. He spent many years as a correspondent for NPR, based in Shanghai, now based in London. And again, he's got a new book called The Shanghai Free Taxi. Here's a tweet from Approximation Zero, who says, how did Frank deal with regional dialects throughout China?
I speak Mandarin, and I read a fair bit. Fortunately, everybody in Shanghai, for the most part, will speak Mandarin. In fact, it is the national language of the country. So that helps a lot. And most of my characters, most of the people that I got to know, the passengers, were migrants. So they knew how to speak Mandarin very well. So I didn't really have to deal with that much. And people who had their own regional dialects, they spoke Mandarin.
Oh,
but I'll give you an example. I was a wedding chauffeur. It's a long story.
Yes, you were. In fact,
yeah.
It's a great story.
So I was a wedding chauffeur. What I ended up doing, we had an idea. And when I say we, my news assistant, who was integral to figuring out, he had a lot of the best ideas for this free cab. We put out an advertisement on Weibo, which is the Chinese equivalent of Twitter, saying we'd be happy to drive some people home for Chinese New Year, which is the largest annual mass migration in the world. And not only did I drive two men home, but they were marrying different people. So I became the wedding chauffeur at this village. And so one of the things that happened is at the wedding ceremony, people were giving speeches and they were going to give it in the village dialect, at which I would have been completely clueless as to what they were saying. And so they did it in Mandarin. But it was funny because the father of the bride didn't know the village dialect either. So we would be sitting together. He was Chinese. And we would be sitting together and they would be chatting around us. And we'd both look at each other and he would say, I have no idea what they're talking about. I said, me neither.
No, that's great. We posted that story on our Facebook page. And one little side story related to that was you met the mother of either the bride or the groom, I forget, but she said, let me show you where I'm going to be buried.
Yes, she was.
Fascinating.
It was not what I expected. I arrived in the village, and the first thing she said was, come and see my tomb. And I was like, okay. And I also thought, you know, you always, every time as a journalist, especially a foreign correspondent, if somebody wants to show you something interesting and offbeat, please see it. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting about that is that according to Chinese tradition, her sons should have made arrangements for her tomb to be built, to be filial sons. But they were farm boys who had become lawyers in Shanghai. They had done extremely well. And she was incredibly pragmatic. And so face to her was the great success of her sons, not them following some old filial tradition. And so she did it herself. And she bore them no ill will. She said, they're too busy for this sort of stuff. I'll take care of it.
I love how traditions sort of have to go through certain transformations to keep up with the times. You also met and got to know a guy who called himself Beer, B-E-E-R, which I think as I was reading about him just reminds me that used car salesmen are the same the world over.
They don't have the best reputation in most countries. And a lot of younger Chinese come up with English names so that they can, you know, communicate better with people from the United States and the West. And so Beer was one of these folks. And when I first met him, because I needed to buy a car for this taxi, it was my own money. I wanted to save as much as possible. So I went to use Car Place. And Beer introduced himself and says, my name is Beer. And I like to beer. I like to drink beer in big gulps, usually 7 to 8 bottles at a time.
Wow.
And more or less said, and sometime we should go out and get hammered. And this was before he'd even shown me a car. And then as I tried to find a car that I wanted, he was always steering me to a completely different car as though I wouldn't notice there was a difference between a Honda and a Toyota. So it was one sort of trick after another. And I found him, hilarious and really exasperating.
You did towards the end of the book. You catch up with him.
I do.
He's
changed.
Different person.
And I, you know, it's as a writer, I felt a little guilty because in the beginning of the story in the book, he is comic relief to some extent. But years later, we're chatting, and I did stay in touch with him, and he now has a wife and a child. He's working down in South China. He's still in the car business, but he has his own vision for starting his own business. And we had a 45-minute conversation that was very sophisticated. And I don't know much about the car business, but it was clear that he had done a ton of homework. And it was like I was talking to a different person. And I think part of this is things happen so quickly in China. Like a year in China is worth about 3 in the States.
Really?
And so
because it's so fast-paced in a way?
Because it is so fast-paced. And so not just the landscape changes, not just the skyline, but the people change very quickly. And so when I was meeting Beer, he had used car salesmanship to a performance art. It was wild. By the time I ended up talking to him at the end, he was much more mature.
Well, you describe him as especially untrustworthy. That's a quote there. But obviously, you have a great deal of affection.
No, I do. I came away really impressed with him at the end. He'd really grown up.
Well, which gets us to a conversation about the kinds of scams that apparently are so, popular in China? Are you just, they're just
very common.
From tea ceremonies to all sorts of other scams.
I think that
is that the underground economy in a way?
No, it's not really. I think what it is people would say historically there is just a great deal of distrust on the streets of major cities in China. Some of it goes all the way back perhaps to the Cultural Revolution where children were pitted against their parents and informing on them. So there's just the bonds of trust have broken down over time. And then when you basically suddenly say it's no longer a socialist economy, now it's a market capitalist economy, but you don't let religion flourish, it's not surprised that you end up with this sort of very a lot of people trying to take advantage of each other. So, I mean, the first thing when I got back to Shanghai, I was just walking down the street and some people tried to lure me into a tea ceremony, which usually ends up – they end up charging you like $700 for sipping tea and they a bouncer threatens you, that sort of thing. But a lot of this stuff was common all over the city, and that's why – another reason why it was challenging, like when I was driving the car you know, I was concerned that people might not necessarily trust me because there is a lot of distrust in the city.
Oh, especially with, get in my cab. It's not going to cost people, you a dime.
And some people definitely did not want to get in. But the fact that I was not Chinese actually was to my advantage because people thought as a foreigner, maybe I would be a little more trustworthy.
Well, you talk about fish scams and financial scams. I mean, they were just sort of almost all iterations.
Yes, there are two people that I got to know through this reporting who were wiped out. One was wiped out in a pyramid scheme. And the other was wiped out by a person that he gave all his money to, a loan shark who was giving him a 20% interest. And a surprise, I'm afraid of no great surprise, the loan shark just disappeared.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's very precarious. You can do very well in China. All of these folks are living much better lives materially than their parents, but it's tricky and precarious.
You also describe, and we shouldn't be shocked or surprised about the level of prostitution. Mm-hmm. You describe people, sort of powerful people, having these quote unquote second wives.
Yes,
these
very
are
common.
Essentially mistresses.
Yes.
Does that tell us something about China, or is that just, you think, what happens when there's just money flowing upwards?
I think when things happen so quickly, people get rich so fast, and there's no sort of moral center or guidance. I think this is what you get, and it's pretty baroque. for instance, there was a guy who in my apartment complex in the financial district was known as a place where people would stash their mistresses.
Yeah.
And there was a man who was the scion of a very wealthy man who owned car dealerships, and every few weeks I would see him pull up in a chauffeur-driven Rolls-Royce. He had a white one and a black one, and he was there to see his mistress and their child. And of course, he parked right out front and left the car right out front, so everybody would know that he was here in his $1 million+ Rolls Royce to see his mistress and his child.
To see his mistress.
Yeah, and I mean that was the whole point. Why?
So you want status,
people, you want people to know that you can afford a mistress
because it says
absolute
that
status.
You're
yep.
You're living the status symbol, I guess.
Yeah.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Frank Langfitt, our guest on Radio Times today. For about 5 years, from 2011 to 2016, he was NPR's correspondent based in Shanghai. He's written a book about it called The Shanghai Free Taxi, and he offered taxi rides in order to help the Chinese people who rode in his cab to feel comfortable talking with him. The book is about some of the people he got to know and what that tells us about China. He's now based in London, where he also reports for NPR. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You quote a number of people. Amanda says, there is no trust. This is China. Mm-hmm. There's no trust here. Another one talks about this fear of you write that the fear of the unknown is very powerful in China.
Yeah, and what I meant by that is that when it comes to censorship, nobody knows where the line is. And this is I must say, the Chinese Communist Party is pretty brilliant in the way that it manages the internet and censorship in ways that I think most of us in the West, myself included, didn't see that they would get to this level. So what they do is, since there are no real red lines, I mean, it's not clear quite where the line is, people police themselves.
Right. And self-censorship. So
yeah, self-censorship. And it's common. And even I sometimes caught myself doing that because I didn't want to put off people. Like when I would meet them, I would be careful about what I said because, you know, really, do you want to be friends with a foreign correspondent from the United States? It's not the easiest, you know, kind of relationship you necessarily want to have given the sensitivities, and things have only gotten tougher. So there are a number of episodes and moments in the book where people self-censor themselves. And then we talk about that process, how they've been thinking of it, why they've decided to do this, where the fear really comes from. And it's the fear of the unknown that they don't know. They really don't know what could happen. And in many cases, nothing bad has ever happened to them at all. It's just that they don't know. And so they're always trying to be careful and always thinking, can I really say this?
Is that by design, you think?
Absolutely, absolutely by
design.
That's
the government's control.
Yeah, there's a great essay on this called The Anaconda and the Chandelier by Perry Link. And the idea, it's a wonderful image, and that is the party is like an anaconda in a chandelier.
That's a terrifying image.
You can see it overhead, and you know it's there, and it could strike, and you're watching to see if it will move. It's a perfect metaphor for what it's like to have a serious political conversation in China, because you just don't know.
Oh, that image is so terrifying.
It puts it better than I could.
Let me ask you a couple of things, sort of comparing China and America, and you talk about losing your temper. I think it was with a stranger.
Yes.
And you're right. In China, you should try to take more time, be patient, be oblique, keep your feelings hidden in conversations. You touch on the main point, chat about other things, then circle back. Many Americans are more direct and less concerned with concealing anger. I always think those sort of subtle differences between people are so revealing about culture.
They are. I think that this is going back more than 20 years in China, and one of the adaptations you have – one of the ways that you have to adapt is you can't be that direct with folks, and you have to take your time, especially if you're trying to get something done in a meeting. Mm-hmm. You really do have to circle back. Now, I would say you shouldn't also overgeneralize. Since I've come to China, there are a lot of people who are a lot more direct. I mean, the Chinese culture, like everything else we're talking about, it changes very quickly. It also depends on what part of China you're in. So a lot of my Chinese friends, once they get to know me, they're very blunt. They'll say, hey, you've gotten fat. I mean, they're very, very direct about those sorts of things. But what was interesting in this rural area is I did get very frustrated because a taxi driver would not let me get by, and I almost rolled my van into a rice field, and he still wouldn't back up to let me go, and I just got really, really angry. And part of what I learned from that experience, because the man I was driving sort of basically lectured me on you're overreacting, was that outside the big cities and even in the big cities, there's not a strong sense of individual rights and a sense of, you know, we have to just naturally give rights to others. And that's when people talk about political change and more liberalization, why some of the models in the West would take a very long time or might not work at all, because that's sort of some of those things that are embedded in Western society were not embedded on that country road where I had this sort of standoff with this taxi driver.
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Carol has an email. As the economy slows in China, what do you predict will be the response of the new middle class and the government who is still trying to economically transform Western China?
Well, this is the key. It's like the 92 Clinton campaign. It's the economy. I mean, that's really the fundamental thing here. And I found this particularly talking to many of the people that I got to know by driving the taxi cab. If the Communist Party can make a transition to a much higher value economy where there are much better jobs, and this is what all the investment in AI is about, then I think that people will accept, even though it's a more repressive situation right now than it was even 2 or 3 years ago when I was working there, I think people will accept that. But as one of the people I was talking to, and this isn't at the end of the book, one of my friends I was talking to said, if they can't fix the economy, if they can't make this transition from manufacturing and heavy investment to really high-value jobs and innovation and global brands, why are they still in power? And that is the question that people will ask. And the Communist Party is terrified of that question because it won a civil war, which is part – you know, 1949, which is one of its claims to legitimacy. It has overseen dramatic economic growth, but it has never stood for election. Now, if Xi Jinping ran for election tomorrow, he'd win overwhelmingly. He's very popular. Many of the people in the book like him. They like his assertiveness, and they like that he cracked down on corruption. But the minute you start having elections, you're setting yourself eventually up to lose an election.
What about the trade dispute with the United States? How do you see that playing out? Speaking about the economy, I mean, we could talk about the American economy, but let's look at it from the Chinese side.
Definitely, it has been hurting the Chinese economy. It came at a very bad time for the president of China. Growth has been slowing for years now. And also there was tremendous amount of debt. And so he was trying to curtail that debt, curtail the growth of the debt, which means there's less money sloshing around for investment. So in fact, one of the folks in the book moves to Hong Kong. She's an investment banker. And I was just on the phone with her last week.
Really?
She can't do all these cross-border deals she wanted because they've tightened up currency controls. She can't get the assets from the mainland to Hong Kong to manage them. And so people are really feeling the pressure. As is, of course, the President of the United States. He doesn't like, you know, he has a stock market that he's very concerned about. He's just launched his reelection campaign. So both Xi Jinping and President Trump have a lot of domestic pressure. I don't think this is likely to get solved anytime soon. And then, of course, you have the targeting of Huawei, which I think bothers Chinese people more because this is this giant – this
for
giant,
G5.
Yeah, this the 5G network.
5G.
But they – Huawei is a very successful company. Chinese rightly should take pride in that company. And they feel that really it's become a victim, a political victim of the trade war. And they, I think a lot of Chinese do resent that.
Do Chinese people talk about President Trump?
Yes, they do. Mixed feelings. I think initially they found his blunt-spoken nature. They found it very appealing, just as many of his core, his base here in the United States do, very different than a leader that you would see in China. They haven't liked the trade war generally, and they don't like the way the relationship is going with the United States. What's very interesting, Marty, is that there are some people – this is amazing – who actually find they like Trump because he's putting so much pressure on the regime. They think that he will force them to open up the economy, which will be better.
Really?
That will be better for GDP growth and people. Right now, part of what the Communist Party is trying to do is hold on to state-owned enterprises as a lever of power. That's not good for the economy. Good for the party, not mm-hmm. good for the people of China, not good. So they see Trump, ironically, as a bit of a reformer. I also talked to one person in the book recently who said that he is so concerned about the repression, he's so afraid of the regime, that anything that weakens the regime, including President Trump putting pressure on them, was a good thing. I got to tell you, I didn't think I would hear that 2 years ago from one of the people in the book.
Almost having a break here, but seeing him as a kind of a disruptor, him
yes.
meaning the president, a
yes.
disruptor.
Yes, I mean in ways that I think none of us anticipated. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about a whole bunch of things on Radio Times today with Frank Langfitt, including what he learned as he was the NPR correspondent based in Shanghai 2011 to 2016. He drove a cab to find out what people really thought about the new China, wrote a book about it called The Shanghai Free Taxi Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We'll also spend a little time talking about Brexit and what's going on in England. Frank Langfitt is now based in London. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me just recap here. When NPR reporter Frank Langfitt was reporting from China, he wanted to get beyond the headlines. He started to drive a cab to find out what was really going on in the new China. He's talking about his new book, The Shanghai Free Taxi. We've been talking a lot about China, Shanghai in particular, and a lot about the Chinese people. He now reports from London. We'll be talking a bit about Brexit. You can join us one, whatever that is, or where whatever the status of Brexit is these days. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I should say that Frank Langfitt grew up in the Delaware Valley here, and he's speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Help us understand what's happening in Hong Kong. These are massive protests.
Massive. I mean, I'm not sure we've ever seen anything this big in Hong Kong.
Millions of people.
Yeah, right? I don't know for sure. The protesters say 2 million. The police, which no one believes, says a few hundred thousand. But it's massive. What happened basically is the government there wanted to create an extradition treaty with mainland China so that people violating the law in China could or have committed crimes in China could then be extradited to the mainland from Hong Kong. Hong Kong, it's a one country, two systems that started in 1997. But Hong Kong is a much freer place. There's rule of law. It's British common law. There's freedom of speech, freedom of the press. It's a part of China, but boy, yeah. It is radically different when you cross that border. People, particularly young people in China, in Hong Kong, saw this as an existential threat to them. What they were afraid would happen is that they might violate some free, you know, some speech rules in China and could be eventually dragged over the border into a legal system where the conviction rate is 99%. So this was terrifying to them, and they came out in enormous numbers. It was certainly the local government in Hong Kong completely misread this, and they've had to back down.
Yeah. So where do you think this will go? And you were actually there at a previous protest a number of years ago.
Yeah, I think at this point there's no point in bringing this bill back. It's not going anywhere. And they'll just bring all the – if they do it, maybe they can water it down. But if they do it, they'll just bring out tons of people. So there's it's a standoff, and it's a difficult thing for the Communist Party because it's become very clear that even though the Communist Party said many – over 20 years ago that Hong Kong could have its own system for the next 50 years, it's very clear that it's reneging on that deal.
Yeah.
And it sees Hong Kong as a threat. Because it is open and democratic. And also, there a lot of young people in Hong Kong do not like the Communist Party. They're very vocal about that. And what China's trying to do, the Communist Party's trying to do, is just turn this into another giant southern mainland city. And it's they're irreconcilable differences. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Communist Party has the leverage. The mainland economy is enormous. Hong Kong is tied to the mainland economy. But you have a young generation there that are fiercely democratic in a way that no one anticipated. The old knock on Hong Kong is all they cared about was money. They weren't political. They would just – you could buy them off. That is clearly no longer the case.
Is there – are there leaders in Hong Kong? Do we know?
Not right now. And part of the reason for that – they had a leader of – in 2014, they had a man named Joshua Wong who became the face. And I interviewed him in the protest camps in 2014. He was the face of the protest movement along with a number of other people. Some of those people have now gone – many of those people have gone to jail. So nobody really wants to be the face of this because they're afraid they'll go to jail for a long time, which also means there's a risk of violence. You know, if you don't have good leadership, it can turn violent, and then the Hong Kong police can use that and say, listen, this isn't political. This is just what they would call hooliganism, and then use that as a pretext to crack down. I think this definitely caught the Communist Party off guard and certainly the leaders in Hong Kong off guard, and so we're going to have to see how it plays out. But it's a big problem for the party.
You were telling me during the break that in the previous protest, you brought your kids.
I did.
And I think that tells us that you thought, well, this is probably a pretty safe place.
Not only safe, it was like a living classroom on civics and democracy. So I went to probably the protest camps over a series of probably six visits over several months. And what I noticed is Hong Kong parents were bringing their kids to teach them about democracy because they weren't able to choose the leader of the chief executive and Beijing had way too much influence on that. And so what I decided to do was bring my daughter and son, Katie and Christopher, down, and my wife, Julie, came. And we spent a Saturday night in the camps, and I gave my daughter a microphone and a recording device, and she went out and interviewed people, and she had wonderful conversations. And one of the women that she talked to said, you know, you in the United States really need to appreciate that you have the ability to vote. You have the ability to vote people out of office. This is what we're fighting for, and you don't appreciate it enough. And I got to say, there is no civics lesson that you could learn in a classroom that had the impact and power from hearing that from somebody who didn't enjoy those rights.
I'm thinking the fact that you are American, you grew up in the Philadelphia area, spent some time reporting from China. Now you're in London. Do you see all the things that are going on in these three countries? Do you see some parallels?
I do. I think particularly in the United States and the United Kingdom, you see an emphasis on nationalism, identity politics, a sense, kind of a politics of grievance. You know, you hear President Trump saying, we get bad trade deals, we're not respected. If you go out into towns in England, you hear them saying, the EU doesn't respect us. They owe us. We saved them from the Nazis. And there's this sense of people owe us something. And even though, in the case of the United Kingdom, a once great country, the United States, the most powerful country in the world, a feeling that they're not being treated right. If you look at Xi Jinping in China, you will hear him say, there is a part of the history that the Communist Party teaches called the Century of Humiliation, in which the Japanese invaded. And it is true. It was very humiliating. And the country was carved up by foreign powers. But part of the narrative of Xi Jinping is it is now a time of great rejuvenation for the nation. This is part of his Chinese dream. And the country is going to take its rightful place at the center of politics and the globe. And I've also seen, and not to go on too much here, but to varying degrees, a backlash against globalization. In the United States and Britain, I would say it is about immigration and who are we as a nation. And in Xi Jinping's case, China has benefited enormously from economic globalization. All the characters here have benefited greatly. But I think that the backlash in China from the Communist Party is a backlash against democracy, the idea of trying to spread democracy. They're very clear. This is not for them. And we don't want you pushing this in our country. And it's a backlash against political globalization.
Again, that's Frank Langfitt. We are talking about some of his observations covering both China and England for NPR. And again, he's got a new book called The Shanghai Free Taxi. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499, covering a lot of territory on Radio Times today, literally. You can also email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. You were in London when the president came for a visit, met with the royal family.
Yes.
There was a fair amount of pomp and circumstance. How do British people feel about the president of the United States?
Well, we can start with London and say in London they don't like him at all, and they usually come out in droves to protest him. And I think that that has a lot to do with values. London is a very cosmopolitan, multicultural city. The president, they certainly don't see in that light. And so they don't like him coming. And many politicians don't like him. He was not invited to speak in Parliament. I know I've spoken to the Speaker of the House, John Bercow. He didn't think the president was really worthy of that honor. That said, if you go and look at the Brexit Party and some very conservative members of the Conservative Party, you will find people who will say to you, and I have these interviews where people would say, if we only had Donald Trump, he would have fixed this Brexit mess. He wouldn't have put up with the Eurocrats in Brussels. He wouldn't have been meek like our Prime Minister, Theresa May, who's on the way out. So you do see some respect for that. You also hear people say, America first, Britain first. That's exactly how it should be.
Wow.
We think that he defends America. We want a Prime Minister who really defends British values and who we are as a people. So there are people who do support him. It is far from the majority. But I think it's interesting to listen to them and how his message not only resonates in parts of this country, but resonates across in a number of places in England.
Does that special relationship between the U.S. and Great Britain, England, does that still exist?
It's not going too well. it's not going too well. He's alienated a lot of people, but it's not just that. There are other factors as well. If you go back, you remember the Iraq War was a real division. Tony Blair sold the Iraq War, as did George Bush, to the population. There was a lot of opposition to this. The British people, many of them have never forgiven Tony Blair for going along
Bush's
with this.
Poodle, right?
Yes. And so I think that was a big, big shift in the relationship. Remember, this is the special relationship came out of World War II, fighting side by side, fighting against fascism in Europe. It's a lot harder today probably to convince British people that they should support another American military action after the Iraq War because they feel they were tricked.
The president, I mean, it should be said he insulted the mayor of London.
Meghan
Markle.
Yes.
I mean, not a great way of
setting
the stage for a visit.
And yet this is his brand. I mean, his brand is to take people on. And actually after that, it was very interesting. After that most recent spat between him and the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, I interviewed Sadiq Khan. And I think that to some degree, Khan went after him first this time around in The Guardian, attacking him. I think, frankly, full well knowing that Trump would counterattack as he did on Twitter as Air Force One was coming into London. I mean, it's sort of remarkable. Nothing like this ever happened in the relationship between these two countries. But the rest, I will say this, the rest of the visit went well.
Yeah.
He got along with people perfectly well. He was dignified. And so while it got off on a very bad foot, at the end, the protests were not as big, and he didn't do anything terribly provocative.
Well, and I love the pictures of him and the Queen walking together. There was just something so unusual. I wasn't sure exactly.
Well, I think we know enough about President Trump.
Like, was she thinking? Well, I was thinking.
Obviously, we live here in Philadelphia. We are very familiar with Mr. Trump from his ventures in Atlantic City and just up the road in New York. And we know that he's always craved this sort of attention and acceptance of people of great status. So an audience with the Queen has to be top on his list. And my sense from talking to people was this was the real reason that, of course, he wanted to go back to the United Kingdom. There was not a lot of business done during that state visit. The Prime Minister was a lame duck. It was really to have the opportunity to go to Buckingham Palace.
Speaking of Prime Minister, there's a vote today.
There is. So we're down to about five candidates
right.
to replace Theresa May, who has in 3 years failed to get the United Kingdom out of the European Union. We're going to see if somebody else can do a better job. At the moment, and it has seemed like this for quite some time, Boris Johnson, the former foreign secretary, a Trumpian figure himself, is way out in the lead. And it'll come down to two candidates, and then it will go – they'll go out on the hustings, and there'll be about 100 – I guess somewhere in the neighborhood of 160,000 members of the Conservative Party who will vote for – who will become the next leader of the Conservative Party, which will then become prime minister. Mm-hmm. So it's like a Republican primary, except you get to be prime minister.
So who do you think the other person will be?
I could be Jeremy Hunt. He's the current foreign minister. He's more moderate. Certainly, he's also more moderate personally. Boris Johnson is a polarizing figure, very popular, just as the president here is, with hardcore conservatives in England. He's also very erudite. He's very funny. He often, if you watch lots of clips of him, he seems like a buffoon. But I've been in rooms with him when he's given good speeches, and he's very, very good.
Okay.
He's very charismatic. There's lots of Shakespearean references. Even if you didn't like him, you can't not laugh at some of the jokes that he makes. So he's a very effective, charismatic politician. The question, though, is, if nobody else has been able to solve this problem, how will Boris Johnson solve it? There's no sense that he has the magic formula for getting the UK out of the European Union without doing significant damage to the country's economy.
Well, I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, as you just mentioned, it seems that no one really knows how to solve the problem of Brexit.
Not that I've heard.
But there is a deadline. Happens to be Halloween.
Completely appropriate.
Where what? What are the options?
Well, the options,
are there any options?
There are options, but none of them are good. They've always been bad options. It's bad and worse. So the options are to leave without any sort of arrangement, which is effectively walking away from an enormous trading bloc with, you know, maybe – if they don't do it correctly, I think they will be careful about this. But you could see tariffs coming on very quickly, and it could really hurt the UK economy. It would also hurt the European economy. It's a pretty destructive kind of move. Another option, which seems, I think, remote but could happen, some people, members of parliament, say to me in the end, since they don't think that the political class and parliament can solve this, of taking this vote back to the people, which would be astonishing.
Really?
I still don't see it happening. There are people who voted to remain in the European Union 3 years ago who say they would vote against it now simply because they don't think it's anti-democratic to bring back such a big question 3 years later. But the referendum in 2016, Marty, has really proved to be Pandora's box. It was never intended to pass. David Cameron, the prime minister at the time, was just trying to solve a dispute within his own party. And it has just paralyzed the country in a way that nothing has politically in decades. It's been astonishing. I got there just a week before the vote. It's been astonishing to witness. The UK's political brand was competence and effectiveness, and it's all just kind of fallen apart.
I mean, that's a very worrisome.
Yeah. It's not good for the
description
West.
Description of the future
and
for England.
And it's not good for the West. You know, this is America, a very important ally of the United States. It's not good for the United States when the parties are fighting each other and they're also fighting inside the parties. The country is polarized. The people who really benefit from this are Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. This disarray in the West.
Well, we've come full circle. Frank Langfitt, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. This was great, Marty.
It was great for us as well. And again, the book is called The Shanghai Free Taxi: Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. And our guest, Frank Langfitt, is speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Spent a couple of years as the bureau chief or the correspondent based in Shanghai. And now he is based in London. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. We'll probably be posting some images, some photos today as well. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us.